regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program. Today we're going to be talking with Joseph Greenlee from NRA's Institute for Legislative Action about the latest news out of Virginia regarding the ban on so-called assault firearms and large-capacity magazines that was adopted by Virginia Democrats. That ban took effect on on July the 1st. It was put on hold on July 21st, so it lasted about 3 weeks before a statewide injunction was put in place. Attorney General Jay Jones had been fighting this injunction, but he threw in the towel this week and has agreed to let the injunction remain in place until the Supreme Court's decision in Viramontes and Grant, the so-called assault weapon cases out of Cook County, Illinois, and the state of Connecticut are decided sometime next term. Probably going to be, you know, next June, I guess, before we get our decision. I think it'll be one of the last decisions of the term. Could come out a little bit earlier than that, but let's say next June. The injunction lasts until next July, so the bottom line is this injunction is going to remain in place. And we don't have to worry as Virginia gun owners about the court stepping in and saying, you know, oh, no, you can enforce the ban, even though we've already said that, you know, you're likely to prevail on the merits here. This is great news, honestly, if unless you're a gun control advocate, in which case this is terrible news because you expended all kinds of political capital to get this ban in place. And as a result, gun sales soared in the Commonwealth of Virginia, particularly sales of long guns. And we're talking with Stephen Gutowski from The Realtor about this earlier in the week. And my back of the envelope math, I think about 200,000 more long guns were sold in Virginia than would have been sold otherwise had the Democrats not put this ban in place. Now, again, at some point, those 200,000 guns would have been purchased, right? But it would have been this year. That would have been spread out probably over the next 2 years. And instead, all those sales took place between really December of 2025 through June 30th of 2026. But the numbers just kept ramping up every month. They just kept getting higher. The increase year to year was just extraordinary. So that's what the Democrats accomplished, ultimately. They sold a lot of guns, and they banned them for a couple of weeks. They banned the sale of these guns and magazines for a couple of weeks. And then they didn't. So I got to say, I was very pleased to see that Jay Jones is no longer going to try to defend this law. He's going to wait until the Supreme Court issues its decision. And we had a great conversation talking about some of the other issues, because it's not just the gun ban. There's the magazine ban component. We talk about the Supreme Court's decision to take up the issue. Joseph Greenlee's reaction to the Third Circuit opinion striking down New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines. By the way, Joseph, if you've never read any of his legal work, great writer, great Second Amendment attorney, and frankly, just a very engaging guy. So I was really pleased that he could come on the program today. It was a great conversation. Take a look and a listen. Joe, thanks so much for coming to the program. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. And as we were talking about off air, it's nice to actually have so much good news to discuss. So let's talk about what's going on in Virginia. The NRA, along with Virginia Shooting Sports Association, a number of individual plaintiffs filed suit, one of four state-level lawsuits against Virginia's ban on so-called assault firearms and large-capacity magazines. You all were able to secure an injunction, and there was some question about how broad this injunction was. The judge went back and clarified and said, oh, no, this applies statewide. It applies to all law enforcement. That kicked in on July 21st. I called a number of gun stores in Virginia on that day, and they were like, oh, yeah, we're selling what we have in stock anyway. Took a little bit of time, I think, for these store shelves to get replenished. But these gun stores are once again able to sell AR-15s, quote unquote, large capacity magazines. And it that's going to continue now, right? Because Virginia Attorney General Jay Jones has essentially thrown in the towel on trying to continue defending the ban while the Supreme Court, you know, has those cases dealing with so-called assault weapons outstanding, right?
Right, right. So just yesterday, the court granted our the parties reached an agreement to stay the case until the Supreme Court decides Viramontes and Grant, which I assume will be probably June of 2027. So our case will be put on hold, and it makes clear that the injunction stays in place, that the injunction makes the firearms ban and magazine bans, they remain unenforceable. They can't be enforced in, anywhere in the state. So that should provide some, you know, kind of stability and assurance to people, you know, engaging in the conduct of selling these items and, you know, purchasing these items. So pretty much puts the Virginia law on hold. And until, you know, hopefully the Supreme Court, as I expect, will say that at least the assault firearm ban is unconstitutional. And, you know, therefore, Virginia's never actually goes into effect.
Yeah, you know, and so you bring up a good point. The Supreme Court did not accept a magazine ban case. They've got a couple of them, Duncan versus Bonna, Gators Custom Guns versus Washington. They didn't deny cert outright. They didn't GVR those cases. They just kind of kept them there in limbo while they granted cert to Viramontes and the two challenges to Connecticut's gun ban. So it is, I mean, it's possible, Joe, right, that the Supreme Court comes out with this decision, says, yep, these bans on, you know, commonly owned centerfire semi-automatic firearms, that they're unconstitutional, but they don't say anything about magazine bans, right?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I sure hope, of course, that, well, first of all, I hope that they take a magazine case now that there's a split. We're filing something in Duncan, our challenge to California's ban on 10 plus round magazines. Today, a supplemental brief saying, hey, there's a real split here now with the Third Circuit and the other circuits. And then you have the District of Columbia Court of Appeals that also struck down the ban, but then took it, DC's ban, but took that case en banc. But now there's an undisputed split that's not going away. The Third Circuit held New Jersey's 10 plus round magazine ban unconstitutional. So we're hopeful that maybe the court says, okay, let's take Duncan, you know, better than send it back. This case has been going on and we filed it like 10 years ago, maybe 11 years ago now, better than sending them, possibly GVRing and having them start all over. And so that's our hope there. But otherwise, hopefully the so-called assault weapon opinions and Viramontes and Grant has some favorable language, which I expect it will. I mean, we got great language on what are arms in Wolford. We should get great language in, I would think, these Viramontes and Grant cases. And but I guess, you know, at the same time, I think it's so straightforward. The assault weapon bans are so straightforward under Heller. I mean, you could write an opinion in maybe three sentences, you know. So like, it's possible they don't actually get into any detail and just say, we said common arms can't be banned. These are the most common rifles in the country. Can't be banned. I expect they'll go and hope they go, you know, a little broader and give us some good language at a minimum, you know, for these magazine cases.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's possible, too, that the Supreme Court could write the decision in such a way that even though they don't take up Duncan, they address magazine bans. Right. Because this is, I think, one of the common features of an assault weapon is it has the ability to accept a detachable magazine. And so, I mean, I think it is possible that the court could weigh in on this without actually granting cert to a magazine ban case separately. I'm with you. I hope that they do take Duncan. And again, that's a possibility when they get back, you know, from their summer break. That's still out there, right? They could assign it to a conference and then grant cert. They could, I suppose, even combine Duncan with Viramontes and a grant going forward. So, yeah, all this is kind of up in the air, but there does remain the possibility that the Supreme Court strikes down these gun bans, doesn't say enough about magazine bans that they're immediately struck down, and then the lawsuit against Virginia's magazine ban would be revived, right? I mean, because the injunction, I guess, is set to expire next July. So if we don't have any definitive news about magazine bans or any definitive decisions about magazine bans, you guys will have to continue litigating that, presumably.
Yes, yes, that's right. The injunction, I think we have 30 days after the Viramontes decision to provide a status update with the court. So it should go at least into probably late July of 2027, the injunction that's in place right now. And but yeah, it's at least possible that we're, you know, now relying on, you know, one good thing about, for example, the motion to stay, the state says that the question at issue here, the federal question is at issue in Viramontes. At first, Virginia was denying that. The Virginia Supreme Court has said the Article 1, Section 13 of the Virginia Constitution is coextensive with the Second Amendment. And so the Virginia Supreme Court has applied Supreme Court precedent, U.S. Supreme Court precedent, to the Virginia Constitution. And the state was resisting that. You know, they came out at first at least saying, yeah, this is, it's a collective right. You know, it's not even an individual right under the Virginia Constitution. They seem to have given up on that by saying this Supreme Court opinion is going to, U.S. Supreme Court opinion is going to control here. So that at least gets that argument off the table, I think. And so hopefully our absolute worst case scenario is we're coming in next July with the assault firearm ban off the table and some really good language for magazines.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed. And again, I hope that we do get a broader decision. You know, I haven't had the chance to talk with you since the Third Circuit created that split on both so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines. I mean, I don't know about you, Joe. I thought it was it wasn't three sentences, right? But it was very straightforward in applying what the Supreme Court has said the test should be. And you had a Biden appointed judge, you know, no hemming or hawing. I mean, just again, laid it out. Yeah, these arms are in common use. They can't be banned, and arms that are in common use can't be dangerous and unusual. What was your reaction when you started reading Judge Freeman's opinion?
Well, a great deal of relief, because for a while there, I felt a little bit crazy making these arguments that it's like, hey, this is really obvious. I think under Heller, it addressed an arms ban, and here's what Heller said. And then other courts, you know, they would come in and bring all these factors into the plain text analysis. You know, how useful are these arms for self-defense? You know, not according to the people, you know, purchasing them through the marketplace for self-defense, but according to, you know, some judge who maybe has never picked up a firearm in his or her life, or, you know, how many rounds are actually fired in a self-defense, an average self-defense situation, or what percentage of guns are actually used in self-defense? You know, they bring in all these considerations into deciding whether these are even arms in the first place. And, you know, you start wondering if you're going crazy, because Heller pretty clearly says all instruments that are useful for, that are used in offense or defense. So it was really, really, really nice to just read and also see how straightforward it was. You know, it's Judge Freeman says, you know, here's the issue. Here's what the Supreme Court has said. That's the answer. And then she moves on to the next question. And, you know, she's not bringing in all these other factors and kind of doing backflips there to avoid Supreme Court precedent. So it was, yeah, really, really rewarding and kind of reassuring and nice to see a court willing to follow Supreme Court precedent on this issue.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, compare that to the First Circuit just a few days later, that they issued their decision in a challenge to Massachusetts ban on so-called assault weapons. And you know, they basically rely on First Circuit precedent. But that First Circuit precedent, as you say, was, you know, like we saw the Seventh Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, it's such a convoluted argument. And I think it intentionally misreads what the Supreme Court has said in Heller, Bruin, and even Wolford about what constitutes an arm. You know, the fact that, you know, arms that are in common use for lawful purposes, not just self-defense, but lawful purposes, you know, they completely read that out of the opinion. And it was what, and then it has to, you know, how many times are these actually used in self-defense? So it doesn't matter if, you know, 10 million people possess these firearms for self-defense. How many times was the trigger pulled on one of these guns, right? I mean, and that's that's, I understand what you say about, you know, sometimes you feel like you're going crazy because we have seen so many of these courts just adopt these standards that are nowhere in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence.
Yeah, and the irony of the how many times is this type of weapon actually used in self-defense situations is the safer society becomes, the more peaceable and law-abiding we all become, I guess we lose rights because our guns are being fired much less often in self-defense. So we're punished for being an orderly society in that regard. But and then another one that they often use, I don't think the First Circuit did there, but the most useful military service, which Justice Alito came out, it must have been his concurrence in Caetano, and said, no, that's not what we said. It's regardless of the weapons utility for military service. The question remains, is it in common use? And courts just ignore that. Yeah, I mean, a lot of them will clearly do whatever it takes to uphold these bans, but hopefully the Supreme Court leaves them no wiggle room after Viramontes and Grant here, and including not just for assault firearms or assault weapons, whatever they're called, and the most popular rifle in the country, but hopefully it also makes clear that, you know, some of these other arms that are harder to quantify, like switchblades or something like that, you know, are protected as well.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think, I mean, Colorado's permit to purchase law for semi-automatic firearms, certain specified semi-automatic firearms, they're not calling them assault weapons. There's some really weird title that goes into effect on Saturday. And I suspect that's where a lot of these gun ban states are going to go if outright bans are struck down. But that's a conversation for the future. I do want to ask you, the first, as I understand it, the first amicus briefs in Viramontes and Grant are due in late August. Is that right?
They're now due September 4th.
September 4th. Okay, so it got pushed back just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, 2-week extension.
Okay, so are you working on any briefs right now? And can you spill the tea at all on what focus your amicus briefs are going to have?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, no problem doing that because it's some material I've addressed. We've filed countless briefs in these cases, but we're going to address the Bowie knives, which are frequently used to uphold these laws, which I guess to foreshadow some of what we'll be arguing, they weren't bans, you know, they were all the concealed carry restrictions, or, you know, you can't carry one with the intent to use it in a crime. They weren't bans on possession or even carry. There was one ban on possession in Georgia. That's the only state that banned possession of Bowie knives, and that was struck down by the Georgia Supreme Court in Nunn versus State. So to the extent, Wolfer makes clear that you look to, you know, how many jurisdictions adopted this historical analogous regulation and how well accepted it was. And the answer to that is one state, and it was not well accepted. It was struck down. So that should be used. And to the third en banc Third Circuit, Judge Freeman's credit, she pointed that out. Many of the other courts out there say, hey, look, the majority of states regulated Bowie knives in some manner. So surely they can justify a ban on the most popular rifle in America today. So we're going to attack that and then get into some of the history of another argument that the Seventh Circuit in Barnett recently adopted was, you know, these semi-automatic firearms represent some dramatic technological change. You know, the founders and 19th
never
century
could have envisioned,
Americans,
right? Yeah.
Yeah, never could have seen it. And repeating arms go back to 1490. They've been, you know, constantly developed, and the founders were well aware of it and embraced it. And it was perfectly foreseeable. Not that that's even required under the Second Amendment, but it was indeed perfectly foreseeable. So we're going to get into that as well.
You know, and not only was it perfectly foreseeable, I mean, again, you talk about going back to 1490, and I saw some, there was a reference to the puckle gun that was floating around X a couple of days ago. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that those repeating arms were probably not common in the 1500s or even the, 1700s, but the technology was there. And more importantly, again, the idea of the idea of repeating firearms, the idea of not having to take, you know, a minute to reload a firearm, like that certainly was present, right? But then when you do see those technological advances, when you start to go from the cap and ball pistol to the repeating revolver to the breech-loading rifle to the repeating rifle, nobody tried to ban them, right? There was no widespread attempt to try to prohibit these firearms. I mean, bans on, you know, so-called assault weapons, bans on firearms really of any kind, those are kind of 20th century inventions, aren't they?
Yeah, well, yes. And, you know, the Continental Congress, Joseph Belton demonstrated his, I think it fired 18 consecutive shots during the Revolutionary War. And he demonstrated in front of leading scientists like Horatio Gates and leading military experts like Benedict Arnold. And, you know, they didn't turn around after they wanted them. They ordered 100 of them. The deal fell through because he said, oh, you know what, I want a whole lot of money. And the Congress didn't have any money. But they didn't turn around afterwards and say, hey, we had to ban that gun, actually, you know. And when Meriwether Lewis carried the Girardani on the Lewis and Clark expedition, filled his journals with it, it's referenced, constantly, first page of the journal, and I think over 100 times thereafter. They're not like, hey, this weapon sounds really terrifying. We better get out there and ban such a thing. And and then of course we saw the development, incredible innovation in the 19th century. Not everything worked out, but every other day people are patenting really creative repeating arms, and no effort to ban them. The there was a very racist 1893 licensing law for Winchesters after somebody successfully used Winchester to fend off a crowd of white supremacists terrifying them, terrorizing their family. And then Florida turned around and said, hey, let's make this thing a little harder for certain populations to acquire. But that's the closest thing to a ban. There's no ban on repeating arms. These bans are a very modern invention, addressing a very longstanding practice and desire of, you know, being able to shoot as many rounds as possible, as quickly as possible to defend yourself, your family, your community, you know, and so on.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to reading your briefs when they come out. And for folks who like reading amicus briefs, get ready, because there's going to be a flood of them on both sides, I'm sure. I think in Bruin we saw, I think it was close to 50, maybe a little bit more than 50 amicus briefs on both sides. You think we'll top that?
I was looking yesterday trying to keep track. I'm aware of at least 30 of them. So far that people are underway. So I guess I don't know. It won't be any surprise. I don't think I'm revealing too much in that. You know, I think we'll probably get around 50. I mean, everyone's going to want to have a say here. Yeah. and help out.
Yeah. Well, Joseph, again, man, I really appreciate you coming on the program. Always enjoy the conversations. Thanks for everything you're doing at NRA, and look forward to talking to you again in the very near future.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
My thanks once again to Joe for joining us on the program, and looking forward to reading the amicus brief or briefs when they come out here. Maybe even get a sneak peek at those briefs before they are submitted to the Supreme Court. But, you know, I if you're watching this program and you watch this program for a while, you're probably as much of a Second Amendment law nerd as I am. And, man, it's going to be Christmas come early in August and September when these briefs start coming in. I even enjoy reading the opposition briefs because it's a great mental exercise. I mean, I'm not an attorney. I never went to law school. I've been covering this issue for 20 plus years, but I enjoy reading what the other side has to say and formulating my arguments to knock their arguments down. So I'm even looking forward to seeing what, you know, the Democrat attorney generals have to say about New Jersey's ban. A lot of this we probably will have seen before. Frankly, you know, I think we're going to get a regurgitation of the Fourth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, Ninth Circuit, Second Circuit, First Circuit, coming from the, you know, gun ban defenders. You'll hear a lot of talk about, you know, dangerously unusual, or you'll see a lot of talk about dangerously unusual weapons and, you know, like machine guns, and military used battlefield weapons of war, Bowie knives. I mean, it's all going to be there. I just don't think it's going to be well received by a majority of the court. All right. On to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Illinois where a Lyle man accused in a boat crash on the Fox River has been denied pretrial release. You know, we were talking yesterday about Illinois' Safety Act and how there are a lot of criminals who are, or at least a lot of individuals who are accused of violent crimes, who are quickly returned to the streets. I don't have to post bond. They're just released. And okay, you show up at trial. Maybe they get an electronic monitor put on them. Oftentimes that doesn't even happen. Well, in this case, the Lyle man who is accused in this boat crash, he's not getting out of jail before trial. And in part, it is because of his lengthy criminal history. Richard Stevenson, he's 45. He's been charged in connection with this boat crash that killed a 48-year-old woman. According to Illinois Conservation Police, they responded about 2:30 Saturday afternoon to a two-vessel crash on the Fox River, where they found a severely damaged 20-foot crown line and a 31-foot South Bay pontoon boat that had run aground. According to prosecutors, Stevenson was operating the pontoon boat when it struck the rear of the crown line at approximately 80 miles an hour. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't realize pontoon boats could go that fast. But it essentially rowed over the smaller boat. And this 48-year-old woman suffered what prosecutors described as catastrophic injuries. She was essentially decapitated. As of earlier this week, they've not released her name. They've not released the name of the man who was injured with her. Stevenson was later found in the trees near the shoreline where his boat had come to rest. There were two other people who had been aboard the pontoon boat who took off before law enforcement arrived. Stevenson was taken to a hospital in McHenry County. Prosecutors said testing showed his blood alcohol concentration was approximately 0.236 after the crash. Approximately 0.20 at the time of the collision. Authorities said that Stevenson had refused a field sobriety testing, a breath test, and initially refused a court-ordered blood draw as well. Prosecutors presented statements from several witnesses, according to Fox 32, on a Tuesday's detention hearing. One passenger on Stevenson's boat told investigators that Stevenson was speeding in a no-wake zone and ignored repeated warnings to slow down. That witness also said that Stevenson had purchased Fireball whiskey at a gas station, had thrown back two shots before he got on the river, also drank at a bar/restaurant before the crash, continued doing shots of Fireball while he's operating the boat. Witness told law enforcement that they saw Stevenson stumbling on the dock when he left that bar/restaurant, but he again got behind the wheel of the boat. Same witness said he feared for his safety. A man who encountered Stevenson after the collision told authorities that Stevenson was crying, said his life was over. According to prosecutors, he also admitted that Stevenson admitted that he'd been drinking. The assistant state's attorney argued that Stevenson poses an ongoing danger to the public. And they pointed to what they described as decades of reckless behavior behind the wheel of vehicles. So, according to prosecutors, Stevenson has previously been charged with DUI 3 times, reckless driving 3 times, 4 misdemeanor speeding offenses. There are also prior convictions involving fleeing police, driving with a revoked driver's license. The assistant state's attorney said this man was a ticking time bomb, and that bomb went off this past Saturday on the Fox River. Stevenson's attorney said, look, he's married, he's got a job, he supports 3 kids, he's consistently appeared in court when he's been ordered to before, and he said, you know, can't we release him on GPS monitoring, home confinement, you can monitor his alcohol use through a scram bracelet, you can bar him from getting behind the wheel of a boat or a car, you can even order him to not drink alcohol, but don't keep him behind bars. And a judge said, no, that's not going to adequately protect the public, ordered Stevenson held in McHenry County Jail pending trial. I see stories like this, and I I can't help but wonder, what was the punishment that Stevenson received, if not for his first DUI, for his third DUI? And, you know, I understand sometimes this involves, you know, license revocation. But unless there's some incarceration, too, I don't think that's much of a punishment. You know, if somebody is going to get behind the wheel while they're inebriated, while they're, you know, highly inebriated, 0.23, I believe, is about almost three times the legal limit in Illinois. And if they've done this repeatedly, why would we believe that taking away their driver's license is going to change their behavior? I've never lost anybody that I love to a drunk driver. I know people who have. I have had family members who have been severely injured, whose lives have been impacted forever because of drunk drivers, but they did not die. And this is an issue that I take seriously. And so I really do wonder, how did Mr. Stevenson rack up so many convictions, so many arrests, so many charges for what is largely the same behavior, right? Acting recklessly behind the wheel, whether or not you're sober or inebriated. He was charged with reckless driving three times. He was charged with DUI three times. How does that happen without the courts intervening at some point and saying, you are a danger to the public? You are going to hurt somebody if we allow this to continue. So we're not going to allow this to continue. And it sounds like that didn't happen in Illinois until Stevenson allegedly killed this 48-year-old woman and severely injured another 40-year-old man. All right. On to better news. Today's Armed Citizen story from Iowa. I guess better is relative. Fort Dodge man found to be acting in self-defense after fatally shooting another man. You know, I am not one who generally cheers every defensive gun use, but I am glad that this individual was able to protect themselves. This from WeAreIowa.com. Fort Dodge police have determined that the man who shot and killed another man last Friday was acting in self-defense. Happened about 2 p.m. Friday afternoon. Police were dispatched to the scene after learning of a man who had been shot. When they got there, they found a man with a gunshot wound, identified as 45-year-old Thomas Henry Aarons of Fort Dodge. He was taken to a local hospital where he was later pronounced dead. Another man identified as the shooter was detained and was interviewed. Following the shooting, officials said that investigators with the Fort Dodge Police, as well as the Webster County Attorney's Office, continued to follow up on any and all leads in the investigation. They said that they learned that Aarons had been attacking the other man. That man tried to retreat, but even when he got into his home, Aarons followed him, continued to attack him, which is where the man ultimately fired one shot at Aarons. He then called 911. So he was the one who, you know, alerted authorities to the shooting. And authorities said after a review of interviews, available evidence in the case, the Webster County attorney determined that the man acted in self-defense and no charges have been filed. We are also looking at another case. Now, this one has not been officially ruled an act of self-defense, but I'm keeping my eye out from Mobile, Alabama, where a business owner says he was forced to shoot and kill a man who came to his business and threatened him as well as others with a firearm. If the business owner's story is confirmed by witnesses, I don't think it's going to take long for police to and prosecutors to officially rule this a case of self-defense. But like I said, we're keeping an eye out on that one. May have more details for you early next week as well. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A 14-year-old who ended up roping a drowning man on the Yellowstone River and saving the man's life. 14-year-old ranch kid, according to Cowboy State Daily, there in Wyoming. An unbelievable story. 14-year-old Jory Thomas, he was visiting his grandparents' campground over the 4th of July weekend. And he's just, you know, practicing his roping. And he hears somebody scream for help. So he emptied his pockets, ran across a side channel, waded west deep into the yellow, waist deep into the river, and ended up roping this man who was drowning. Cowboy State Daily says the July 5th rescue unfolded so quickly that by the time the first Sweetgrass County Sheriff's Office deputy arrived 3 minutes after Jory's father called 911, everybody was already safe on shore. And Sheriff Alan Runneberg told Cowboy State Daily, "My opinion, Jory saved the individual's life 100%. Said, had Jory not acted, I believe his chances of this individual making it to shore or not making it to shore, very slim." Jory Thomas lives with his family in Montana, again, visiting his grandparents for the weekend. He had wandered over to visit with his parents and his grandparents that afternoon. He's just practicing throwing loops. And Jory's father, Jace Thomas, told Cowboy State Daily, all of a sudden he heard some yells for help. A boat had apparently struck a bridge pillar, and everybody on the boat got thrown into the Yellowstone River. Three people fell in. Two of them were able to get out. There is one person still in that river. He's clinging to a cooler, basically. And Jory's dad says somehow Jory convinced the drowning man to let go of the cooler and then threw the rope, catching the man around the neck and one arm, and then able to pull the guy to safety before emergency responders ever arrived. It's amazing. Jory talked with KTVQ in Billings, Montana, and said he wasn't thinking about the danger to himself. He just acted on instinct. He said, you know, the current was pretty fast then. He was moving pretty quickly. He said, the only thing I could focus on was helping him get out of the water because I didn't want to see anyone go in front of me. Jory's dad, by the way, 3 decades on the Big Timber Volunteer Fire Department. I'm guessing that dad has instilled some pretty important lessons in Jory's life. And again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to save a stranger in need, 14-year-old Jory Thomas, we thank you for your very, very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again on Monday. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com between now and then. We are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from across the nation, including the latest filings by the DOJ and its lawsuit against the U.S. Virgin Islands. Oh, that one was a fun one to read. We've got the Armed Citizen stories for you. I keep hearing scuttlebutt about the Third Circuit decision in Coons and Siegel. This is the challenge to New Jersey's sensitive places. I keep hearing scuttlebutt that this is coming out relatively soon. I don't know that that's the case, but it certainly is one of those lawsuits that is outstanding. We are awaiting a court decision. It could come down at any time. I would love to get that news today or Friday, but whenever that breaks, we'll have it for you at Bearing Arms. But there's so much litigation out there right now that honestly, it seems like every day there's a new development in one or more lawsuits. So that's keeping us busy. And we've got a lot more for you as well. So be sure to check out BearingArms.com. We'll see you back here for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company on Monday. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.